From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Grit is the new buzzword in education, in parenting, in careers. Nowadays, it seems everyone is embracing it. What exactly is it? Psychologist Angela Duckworth says it's enduring effort, sustained passion, resilience in the face of setback. It's the secret sauce that can determine success more than IQ. This hour on Point, how to find your inner grit. You can join us on air or online. What does grit mean to you? Are you born with it? Can you grow it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org, on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me in the studio this hour is Angela Duckworth, professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and a 2013 MacArthur Fellow. She also founded, she's the founder and scientific director of Character Lab, which is a nonprofit working to advance the science and practice of character development in children. Her new book is Grit, the power of passion and perseverance. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Angela Duckworth, welcome to On Point and congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So give us a working definition. What is grit?
Grit is not giving up on something that you feel is intrinsically interesting to you and personally meaningful. Not just not giving up, but trying to get better every day.
So talent, intelligence, all overrated? It just comes down to this grit?
It's not that talent or intelligence doesn't matter. I'd like to be a little more talented if I had the choice, a little more intelligent. But I think in our society, we talk so much about whether you are or are not gifted, whether you have it or you don't have it. I think we overlook the importance of effort.
What's the difference between grit and hard work?
You know, one thing that makes it very important to, you know, in terms of thinking about what real experts are made of and how they got that way, it is not just the thousands and thousands of hours that they've put in. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll be an expert if those thousands of hours feel hard. Importantly, if you are truly gritty, while you are putting in those thousands and thousands of hard hours, you are very intentionally and self-consciously trying to work on a particular aspect of your overall performance. So it's problem-solving practice. It's intentional. It's thoughtful. It's not just brute force.
Problem-solving and practice. In your book, you talk about your experience as a teacher and how surprised you were when students who quickly understood the material didn't do as well as kids who initially struggled a little bit.
I often find in my data that either grit has no relationship at all with measures of talent or IQ, or sometimes that the more talented kids or adults are slightly less grittier on average. Why? You know, if you think about it, in a way, it makes no sense at all, because if you're the kid for whom things come easily, rationally, shouldn't you spend more time because you get so much out of every moment? Well, it turns out that that's not the case. And I think the reason is that if things come really easily to you, you don't necessarily learn the skill of getting back up again when you fall down or struggling a bit and getting through to the other side because things have been so frictionless.
You start the book with a great illustration of grit from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Tell us that story. Tell us about the grit scale.
The leadership of West Point has been interested in why some men and women stay through, for example, their first hard summer of training, which yes, they call it, you know, even in official literature, at one point I thought it must be a nickname, but they actually call it the Beast because it is by design that hard to take your, you know, soft and squishy 18-year-old self and turn you really into an elite military leader. Now, some men and women, of course, most of them make it through that hard training, but more than you would think, drop out. And the question was, why is it? Because all of these men and women are really actually qualified to be there. The rigors of getting into West Point are, you know, famous, and I don't need to recount them here. But when I went to West Point to work on this age-old puzzle, I came equipped with my grit scale. This is my measure of grit. It simply captures in a self-report questionnaire how persistent you are towards things that are difficult to achieve and how enduring your passions are. And it turns out, and it's been the case every year since, because we've been doing research at West Point for over a decade, that the grittier you are on this questionnaire, the more likely you are to make it through that first summer, whereas measures of talent at West Point have no predictive power over making it through that summer.
So not your SAT scores, not your leadership experience, not your athletic ability necessarily. It's that grit.
It is. And it's a, you know, a finding that I find to be in some ways tremendously optimistic, because for many of us who think, well, I'm not blessed with the greatest amount of athletic ability, or, you know, maybe I'm not blessed with the greatest amount of intellectual acuity, but if I have enough, then I might still get through things and do something here.
You tell your story in your book, your story of developing grit, and you write about your dad, who focused a lot on your talent and intelligence. How did that shape you?
My dad has been sort of singly obsessed with achievement for his whole life. And when I came along into his life, I got swept up into that as well. And at the dinner table, you know, he would debate whether Einstein or Newton was the greater genius. Because I think for my dad, not only was it important to be achieving, successful, but I think he had a theory that, you know, if you're really, really smart, then, of course, you know, that gives you the shot that you wouldn't have if you're not. I will say this, too. My dad evolved as a person, and the father that he was for me when I was a very little girl was not the same father that I had later on in life. And I think he came to appreciate more and more that sticking with something because you love it and working hard on it every day was at least as important.
You write that he reminded you often, you're no genius, Angela.
He did. And he would say to my mother, who's an artist, he would say to her, you know, again, out of the blue, unsolicited, you know, Teresa, you're no Picasso. So those kinds of, you know, superlatives, those comparisons were, you know, they were all around when I was growing up.
A girl who'd been repeatedly told she's no genius ends up winning an award for being one. A Marshall Scholar at Oxford awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, which is often referred to as the Genius Award. What'd your dad think of the book?
You know, my dad, by the time that the book was finished, was, you know, fairly, as he is now, in late stages of Parkinson's disease. So I did read the book to him. I don't know how much he could appreciate, but he did smile. And I feel like in some ways I read the book for myself. Maybe it was less important for him than it was for me.
How do you measure grit? Something that's so intangible.
You know, for centuries, I think, you know, philosophers have wondered whether you could ever put a number on virtue, right? So maybe you can't. That was, you know, the prevailing thought. I think in the last few decades, psychologists have been trying to put a number on many things that that have been hard to measure, grit among them. I mentioned already that I developed a questionnaire called the Grit Scale, but there are other ways of looking at grit as well. For example, if you think about high school, many kids, certainly the ones who've had the opportunity to engage in extracurricular activities. One way to measure grit is how many years does a high school student pursue the same extracurricular activity, whatever it is, track, school newspaper, can even be driving for Domino's Pizza. Do they do it for more than 1 year, and can they make progress? Can they overcome obstacles and get better?
Well, doesn't that go to the 10,000-hour rule, right? If you do something long enough, you're going to get better at it.
Well, I think you're going to hear from Anders Ericsson, who'd be better equipped to
yeah,
give the nuanced
program,
direction.
Yeah.
But I will say this for my part. It is about hours. It is about time on task. There are no shortcuts to excellence. But it's very much about quality. So 10,000 hours of shallow practice won't make you into an expert.
Mm. Very successful people that you've talked with, whom you interviewed for this book, say they can recognize it, but you can't really directly test for it, right? So are you born with this? Can you learn it? Can grit be learned?
You know, there's a very important role for genetics in just about everything that you can think of. You know, your waistline, your risk for skin cancer, your height, whether you're extroverted. And in fact, in a recent study I read, you know, whether you like chicken and broccoli, right? I mean, really everything about us is influenced by our genes, but not entirely determined by our genes. So yes, we inherited DNA from mom and dad. That DNA will incline us to be a little more gritty or a little less gritty, but there's a huge role for our life experience.
So what distinguishes high performers or high achievers is largely how they process feelings of frustration and disappointment. I think that's what you write in your book, right? How they handle setbacks, the struggle.
You know, for real experts to keep improving, they have to daily confront what they are not good at. You know, we watch the Olympics to see what people are good at, but most of the time, experts are thinking about what they could do better. And I think the ability to master emotion-free, shame-free mistake-making really is a key to getting better at anything.
And how do you do that? How do you teach a child to do that?
What's interesting about children is that if you think about a one-year-old, you know, learning to walk and run, you know, two-year-old, three-year-old, one, two, and three-year-olds, the preschoolers in our lives make mistakes all the time. You know, they're dropping things. They're screwing up. They do so without shame. What's interesting is that around the age of five, when kids go into school and they see adults have those facial expressions of, ooh, no, not six blocks, five blocks. Oh, no, the red one, not the orange one. I think what they see for the first time is that there's something bad about mistake making, that it's not, you know, okay, well, this is part of learning. And we send that signal, I think, in very, implicit, hard to measure ways, but they're very real. I think the challenge then for us is to kind of get back to our preschool selves, screw up, drop things on the floor, fall down, get up again, and figure out how not to drop it the next time.
Back to our preschool selves. Okay, that's a good quote for the day. Why a book about grit, Angela Duckworth? Why a book about grit?
Well, I didn't want to write this book.
You did not.
I did not want to write this book. I have a husband named Jason who sat me down in a chair in our living room, the red chair, and he said, you have to write this book because if you don't write this book, people will misunderstand the scientific research. And everything you've worked for is to get people to use the scientific research to make kids' lives better.
And what's the most surprising thing you learned from a book you didn't really want to write?
Maybe the most surprising thing that I learned is that even for somebody who is fairly gritty and studies grit for a living, that doing that thing that is at the edge of your abilities, for me, writing a book was inconceivable. I mean, who could write a whole book? To me, it was just, beyond. That you prove to yourself that you can.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Angela Duckworth this hour, professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Her new book is Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. You can join the conversation. Is grit enough to push you over the top if you don't have basic opportunities, if you're worrying about your next rent check, the next meal? Here's some sound in an interview with NPR's Morning Edition in 2014. Education writer Alfie Cohn said that focusing on grit distracts from other educational problems in grade schools.
Grit's taken off like a fad in education because that's a convenient distraction that doesn't address the pedagogical and curricular problems in the schools. The more focus there is on self-discipline, the less likely it is that we make the kind of changes that can help our children go to better schools.
So less grit, more self-discipline. What do you say, Angela Duckworth?
I think the worry that if you use grit or self-control or any other aspect of character as an excuse for telling ourselves that, it's the kid's fault and we're sort of done our jobs as adults and if they rise or fall, it's now their problem. That's very dangerous and it's not at all what I intend. On the other hand, whether you're from a very wealthy and privileged background or you're not, I think learning to stick with something that's important to you is a life skill we all have to develop. I will say this. I've been in classrooms where sitting in the back, I think to myself, holy smokes, they need a lot of things, not just grit, but to Alfie Cohn's point, engaging curriculum, classroom management, teachers who are really equipped with the skills to help their students learn. So it's not that grit is everything, but I absolutely believe it's important for everybody.
Right, because there are those who say this works for a certain population with resources and opportunity, and that no matter how much grit you've got, it's not enough to overcome poverty, of inequality. And, you know, when you're worried about the basics like food and housing, who cares about grit?
I think that to make a false dichotomy between our opportunities and our character is dangerous, and it's wrong in the following sense. You know, if you ask yourself, well, where does character come from? You know, where do kids learn to stick with things and to be nice to other people, et cetera? You know, is it separate from their situations? No. We are forged by our situations. So I don't want to pit character and circumstance against each other. These are deeply, deeply intertwined, and you cannot pull them apart.
What about the idea that grit, you know, that determination that you talk about, that perseverance can easily become a lack of flexibility, a sort of tunnel vision, even an ability to learn from your mistakes? You can't do it because you're so focused on one thing.
You know, there is an element of grit, which is just stubbornness. And I remember being called a stubborn little girl. I think that was an accurate description. I think where grit can be a dangerous thing is if you are gritty about the wrong thing. If you are really gritty about these kind of low-level goals, as I call them, you know, these things that are on your to-do list for the next day or the next month, then you can get kind of into a hole sometimes, right? You know, for example, if you didn't get into the college you want, are you just going to like keep applying every fall to the same college, you know, 10, 11 years later? Well, that would be a silly application of grit. However, if you ask yourself why you wanted to go to that college in the first place, the question why typically gets you to a higher level goal, something a little more abstract, frankly, something more meaningful. If you ask your question, well, why did I want to get to that college anyway? Maybe it's because you wanted to get a little closer to medical school. Then you can ask yourself, all right, well, how do I stay stubborn about that higher level goal and be more flexible about the lower level one?
I've got callers lined up around the block here. Let's get a few in. Elaine from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Elaine. Welcome to On Point.
I'm just so happy to hear about this book. I evidently have true grit because I line up with all the things you've talked about in my experience with people who are my students. I can see that same thing. Mm. My mother always called me stubborn, and that was a bad thing. Eventually, when I got older, I just changed it to determined. But now I know that I'm gritty. I've always been called and thought of as an underachiever. People would look at me and never expect anything of me, but I would always solve the problem, or I would always come up with the mark that they would be surprised at. I see that in my students who were algebra students from the inner city, that I would much rather have a student who had less capability and more determination than one who had plenty of capability and was almost sometimes just lazy.
Elaine, thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, one thing I can say, Elaine, is from our research, I can tell you that grittier teachers seem to beget this quality in their students. So, for example, the grittier the teacher, the more likely students are really going to make academic advances, which, as you point out, takes so much effort. So I think one very important thing that any grown-up can do, but particularly teachers, is to model grit for young people.
Hmm. Sarah in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air with Angela Duckworth.
Jane, how are you all?
Thank you. Glad you called. Go ahead.
Good. Well, I was very interested in the genetic component, or whether grit is something that you're born with or whether you develop it as you develop. And I just think that my mother played such a huge role in my having grit. I had three older brothers. I was born, and they were, you know, ruthless, relentless, as boys might be to the first girl who's stealing all their thunder. But my mother told me that I could do anything I wanted. And so I was determined to do just that. And as an adult, that has stood me in very, very good stead.
Sarah, thank you.
Well, Sarah, I think we can be sure that you got at least two things from your mom. I mean, you did get 50% of your genes from your mom, and I would hasten to just give a role for that, right? So she did pass on her DNA, and that's surely got something to do with your grit. But the other thing that she passed on is so very important, which is her words, her stories, her own story, her encouragements. And when you gave me a glimpse into what your mother was saying to you as a little girl, it reminded me of Kat Cole. She's the CEO of Cinnabon, came from nothing, you know, came from really poverty and, you know, single parent household. And she said to me, when I was a little girl, my mom stared into my eyes like she was staring into my soul, and she put her hands on my shoulders, and she said, "Kat, you can do anything." And I think that's at least as important.
Let me ask you about the famous Tiger Mom book. In her memoir, Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, Amy Chua outlines her demanding parenting strategy. And I want to play a bit. Here she is describing that parenting philosophy of hers in a 2012 interview on the Today Show on NBC.
I don't think it's really about berating or the violin. I think it's about assuming strength rather than weakness in our children and basically helping them be, you know, the best that they can be.
How is what you're saying different than what she is saying?
Well, there's a line. Well, you know, I would say that there's the, you know, the certainly the popular view of the Tiger Mom message is different from my message. I think many people understand the Tiger Mom philosophy to be all discipline and all hard work and very little self-generated passion anyway, right? You know, you get kind of assigned to the violin or the piano by your parents as opposed to choosing to do the piano violin. I think it's very important that kids have as much choice as they are capable of for their age. So, for example, when my kids were 5 and 6 years old, I've got two girls and they're one grade apart, I didn't tell them that they were going to play the piano or the violin. I asked them from the following choices, like, which of these hard things do you want to do? That said, I think that Amy Chua herself is actually more supportive and more autonomy generating as a parent than people really give her credit for. Because if you actually read the interviews of her daughters who were writing about her when she was also writing her book and, of course, now are older and have since, you know, gone on the air and talked about what it was like to be raised by Tiger Mom, you get the message that even though the book really emphasizes, or her book, you know, emphasizes discipline and hard work, her own parenting style was actually very warm.
But what if your kids choose nothing? I mean, you talk about, you know, here's a list. You can do these of these hard things. Which one do you want to do? I mean, what if they say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't want to do any of them. How do you motivate a kid like that?
Well, you, and I know you've got, you know, you've got the same problem as a parent as I do, right? Different ages, but same dilemma. Yeah. You know, there it is multiple choice, right? My daughter said horseback riding. Daughter Lucy said, my hard thing is going to be horseback riding. I was like, it's a multiple choice, actually. It is not fill in the blank. But on this multiple choice question, there is no answer which is none of the above. So in my family, you don't have a choice. You have to do a hard thing, but you do get to choose it.
Here's Brandon in Urbana, Illinois. Hi, Brandon. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
So my feelings are just on the general build of this inner grit that people have. I'm a disabled combat veteran, fairly young. I deployed to Afghanistan 2010 to 2011, and I'm 26 now. So what I want to get to really is this feeling of grit. I feel like it's instilled and culminated at the early stages of a child's life by their family, specifically, you know, the parental presence, if you will. And As I grew up and I went through the military, you know, I was always insured, regardless of what was going on, that, you know, I could do anything. I could aspire to be anything. Sort of like the, you know, 90s program Reading Rainbow, you know, I can be anything. So after I got out of the military, that's when I really had to sit down and feel out what this grit really is, like my self-determination, my perseverance to keep pushing forward. Because now that I'm out, it's been 3 years now, almost four, I'm still struggling daily to figure out, you know, what is my next step? Not so much my end game, but what's my next step to get to my end game?
Brandon, thank you so much for the call and for the thought and for your service. I appreciate it. Speak to that, Angela. I mean, how much of grit is forged in the crucible of adversity? Brandon's really feeling that right now.
You know, I think there are two things that Brandon's remarks bring to mind. One thing that Brandon talked about is, you know, whether or it's a question, but, you know, from his own experience, you know, these early childhood experiences and how essential they are. To that point, I'll just say that absolutely. But at the same time, I don't think it's ever too late to increase your grit, to develop your interest, to figure out what your purpose is in life and, you know, how to work hard and how to get up when you fall down. I don't think it's ever too late to learn any of those lessons. And the second thing, when Brandon was talking, I was thinking about a lot of people that I've interviewed. I call them grit paragons because they really exemplify power, the passion and perseverance. When you talk to some people who, for example, because they're an athlete and at some point they retire, you know, they face the same crisis that you are, which is that they've been very gritty in something, but now they can't do that thing anymore. Now what do they do? And I'll tell you that it's never easy, but after a period of reflection, many of these grit paragons figure out what the kind of, you know, abstract, what is the thing that made them so excited about that very first endeavor? And they often pivot to something which doesn't exactly look like the same thing, but in a very real way is. Just a quick example, I was talking to a media consultant. You know, he coaches people on how to do things like this radio show, and I guess he was coaching me. And I asked him why he did that, and he had been a journalist himself for decades, really did well, you know, won awards, and then realized that what he really was after in life was a more general project, which is like how to help people tell their stories. And so now he has a, you know, for-profit company, and he does the same thing, but in a different way. So I would ask you to think about, like, what is it about the military that was so meaningful to you? And then ask yourself, is there another project to which I can devote myself for years that's in the same direction?
I want to play some sound here. This is Harvard psychology professor Howard Gardner in a 2015 TED Talk in Boston. He says that teaching grit alone is not enough, that grit should be taught in the context of good citizenship.
People like Hitler and his stormtroopers had lots of grit. That wasn't their problem, but they put it to evil uses. So, great to have grit, but what I'm interested in and what I've worked on for the last 20 years after multiple intelligences is what it means to be a good person, a good worker, and a good citizen.
How do you integrate those two?
Howard actually sent me an email right after he gave that TED Talk, and we agree. And here's what we agree about. It's not just important that our kids learn to be gritty and self-controlled or have a growth mindset, because of course you can apply your grit and your self-control and your growth mindset to completely selfish or even evil ends. And he's right. Hitler likely did have a prodigious amount of grit and optimism and the like. So it's very important that we think about other things that we want our kids to be. And when Howard says being a good person, I think what he really means is, you know, all of those things that help us get along with other people and give back to people who are not us. And that is very much an important part of education.
Let me get Laurel in here from Franklin, Tennessee. Hi, Laurel. You're on the air with Angela Duckworth.
Hi, Jean. Hi. I'm Angela. I'm very appreciative of your work. I think this is a wonderful, noble body and collection of work. Unfortunately, I have to completely disagree with these theories. I feel like they're completely antithetical to the concept of what grit actually is. Grit is something that is purely an American value. It went into what helped build our country, the roads, the pain, the suffering, that character that came along with the courage that went into having to do things that weren't so easy. I just don't think there's a fluffy side of grit. I think it's sort of a value that's dead in America today. It comes from a lot of hardship and pain, but finding peace and happiness within a physical structure of something. So does that make sense? I completely hear you, but I don't think you can really intellectualize grit. And I think there's no softness that goes with that word. That's my comment.
Okay.
I come from an agrarian, agricultural calendar and the agricultural roots that that built our country and that
more
made us as Americans.
Physical, the backbone of this country. I hear you, Laurel. Angela, how would you respond?
Well, I don't think you can get very gritty by sitting around reading a book and not doing anything. So there I agree with you entirely. And to your own personal story, two of the people that I interviewed who taught me so much about what grit really means are Sherry, and I should say his name actually is Grit, Sherry and Grit Young. They're the parents of Steve Young, the legendary NFL quarterback. And like you, they grew up on a farm and they have stories about picking strawberries and about how backbreaking that is and how they were learning lessons in the fields when they were kids that they don't know that you could intellectually learn. I will say this, from neuroscience evidence, it is absolutely true that thinking abstractly about challenges and how you'll overcome them is very, very different from actually going through the challenges and overcoming them. So I agree, but it's also important to have something of a roadmap, and that's what I hope my book is.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the industries at risk of disruption to understanding bouts of market volatility, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Angela Duckworth this hour, professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Her new book is Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. You can join the conversation. Employers, are you looking for grit? How do you know it when you see it? Let me go now to Tallahassee, Florida. Anders Ericsson is on the line, professor of psychology at Florida State University, where he studies deliberate practice. He is author of Peak, The New Science of Expertise. Anders Ericsson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Anders. How are you?
So you use the term deliberate practice, Anders. What is that?
Well, I think our perspective is to identify some type of performance that you want to excel at. And we basically have, you know, worked backwards by looking at those people who really excel to kind of identify their path to be able to do the kinds of things that they do. And I think that has led us to focus in on the kind of mental structures and the way of thinking and imaging that's associated with very high level of performance. So basically, during this long period of preparation, you're actually building up new structures. And that's the reason why we argue that innate talent, or basically the basic abilities that you had before you started with the activity, actually end up not being related to your success at the very higher levels.
So does deliberate practice then require some sort of tutor or mentor to work with you? Something, you know, do they have to teach you something that you can't do on your own?
Exactly. And I guess the idea is that by having a teacher who knows all the effective training techniques, and they can actually look at where you're at and judge now, what is the appropriate activity that you should try to improve within the next couple of weeks? And then string that together in order to build the kinds of structures that eventually will allow you to perform at a very high level.
All right, bring this into everyday life for me. How do you incorporate deliberate practice into work, into running faster, to doing math better, whatever it may be?
And I think that's one of the more important things is that we find that what people would spontaneously do, if you go out running pretty much the same kind of distance every day, you're not going to get any better. But what basically the research have shown is that engaging in interval training, you can actually strain the physiology. So pushing yourself maximally for 100 yards and then basically relax a little bit and then keep pushing, that sets in motion basically activations of genes that are part of DNA that will actually now lead to the buildup of capillaries, even increase in the size of arteries and the heart if you sustain this type of training for very long periods.
So how do you create a culture of grit in the office, in the classroom, even in your own family?
Personally, I think valuing now and giving good feedback about the kind of performance that you have and having teachers that would actually help individuals see how they can actually improve to produce a high level of performance. Now, we view kind of deliberate practice as kind of instrumental. It's the most effective way to reach this high level of performance, but it's basically not something that you do just for its inherent enjoyment.
Anders Ericsson, thanks so much. Professor of psychology at Florida State University, author of Peak, The New Science of Expertise. Really appreciate your time, Anders. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me get back to the phones here, but first let me play some sound. This is from the 2015 movie The Martian. Astronaut Mark Watney, played by Matt Damon, survives on Mars against all odds. And at the end of the film, Watney leaves his students with his wisdom.
Everything's going to go south on you. Everything's going to go south, and you're going to say, this is it. This is how I end. Now, you can either accept that, or you can get to work. That's all it is. You just begin. You do the math. You solve one problem, then you solve the next one, and then the next. And if you solve enough problems, you get to come home.
And here's actor Will Smith in a 2008 interview on NBC's Today Show, claiming that acquired skill, not talent, led him to success.
The separation of talent and skill is one of the greatest misunderstood concepts for people who are trying to excel, who have dreams that want to do things. Talent you have naturally. Skill is only developed by hours and hours and hours of beating on your craft.
Let's go back to the phone. Susan in Boston. Hi, Susan. Thanks for waiting and welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. First, I just wanted to say thank you so much for your program and for also this subject. It has always fascinated me. I'm a mom. I'm 40 years old. I have three beautiful children. My own mother basically just disowned me when I was about 16 because of her mental illness. And I've raised myself. I come from a long line of strong women. I have a grandma that made it through the Great Depression on her own, building a business, feeding her family. And so I think about it often, what is it about nature versus nurture, where nurture in that, you know, our family, our loving family, what they give us, but then, you know, nature comes along and those life experiences, and they beat us to the ground, you know? And I think the place to find what grit is by talking to people who have overcome those life obstacles and are shining, you know, they're still shining their love and light out to this world, and those that crumble. And I know that the experiences that I've faced as a woman, as a mom, others may have crumbled under that. What was it about me?
Right.
Nurture, nature, personality, all of that together that gave me that grit, that survival, to still shine my light.
That secret sauce, Susan. Thank you so much. What a great call. Angela?
Yeah, I think that the question that you're asking about nature versus nurture goes back ever since people were asking questions, really. And the modern answer, based on science, is nature and nurture, not either or, but both. And we can't really say much more than that. You know, we can't say that it's, oh, it's this gene over here on this chromosome. It turns out even for very simple things like how tall you are, something like 700 genes are at least involved in that, interacting in super complex ways. So I can tell you, yes, nature and nurture, but I can't double click as much as I'd like on exactly how this all unfolds. I will say this, your story reminds me a lot of this kid who emailed me out of the blue named Cody Coleman. It was after I'd done a TED Talk, and he said, much like you, that he grew up in, you know, really, really tough circumstances, didn't have the support that he needed, ended up, and this is where he was writing me from, at MIT on the cusp of graduating with a nearly perfect grade point average, majoring in electrical engineering and computer science. And if you ask the question like, well, gosh, how does somebody like Cody Coleman end up shining his light when he's been, you know, growing up in darkness? Cody himself doesn't have a complete answer. I mean, that's the first question I asked him. This is what science needs to do, is to try to figure out where Cody Coleman comes from. We have some clues, though, and Cody had some of them himself. You know, he had a brother who turned to him one day. I mean, Cody was just a kid. He was in, you know, special ed classes, remedial courses, not somebody that anybody would expect to grow up to go to MIT. And his brother said to him, where do you want to go to college? And Cody laughed a little and, you know, I'm not going to go to college. And his brother said, no, I'm serious. Where do you want to go to college? And Cody said, as a joke, he said, Princeton. And his brother turned to him and looked him in the eye and he said, you could go to Princeton. Now, it turns out that Cody ended up not wanting to go to Princeton and wanting to go to MIT and then making it there. But here's a second story, and I think it illustrates the point. He had a math teacher named Chantel. I just saw her last night. And Chantel saw this little guy, scrawny little kid in her class, realized that he didn't have the clothes that he needed, realized that he didn't have the dentistry that he needed, realized that he didn't have the mother that he needed, and provided all of those things for this little kid in her classroom. And I think that when you find stories of resilience, you more often than not will find that there are those other caring adults who served as parents even when the parents weren't there.
Let's go to Rachel in Canton, Ohio. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
My question is, do you feel that there can be certain events that happen in one's life to sort of spark their inner grit? With my mother growing up, she sort of had, you know, a little bit of a rough childhood, never really had any academic training. And it wasn't until that she actually had me that she enrolled herself in college, got her CPA license, worked full time, had me, and that is now the CFO of her company. And it seems like, is this something that you feel she was already, you know, was already in her genes? That she was already capable of this?
Or did something trigger her? Yeah. Rachel, thank you so much. Great call.
I think that that story illustrates exactly what I mean by the fact that, A, people grow. You know, if you're not very gritty today, I'm not going to tell you that you're never going to be gritty. It's untrue. Somebody can actually develop a capacity to get up again and be resilient, capacity to do hard practice. As Anders has pointed out, it's not typically fun, right? But you can learn to do that, and you can learn to find something that you care about. I think that the idea that this might happen all at a single point in time, well, I do think that there are pivotal experiences. I do think there are things that happen to us, like the birth of a child, that do change us. But it's not that all that growth happens in an instant. It's really a series of instants, one after another.
The characteristics you describe in this book, let me turn this to you for a minute. Is there a flip side to this? You know, people with grit who can never really catch up to their own ambitions. They feel like they're never good enough. They're never satisfied. You know, there are trade-offs to some of that, right? You're not terribly peaceful often. You have unrealistic expectations about what you can achieve at the expense maybe of some mental health issues.
You know, we looked at this question directly in our data. We asked people to fill out the grit scale, but we also gave them a battery of well-being questionnaires. Positive emotions, how frequently do you feel them? Joy, calm, pride, strength. Negative emotions, anxiety, depression, sadness, worry. And then a life satisfaction questionnaire. Overall, how satisfied are you with your life? Here's what we found. When you look at grit scores as they relate to happiness and life satisfaction, they go hand in hand. And even at the very tippy top of my scale, the 4.6s, even the 5.0s, they are more happier on average versus less happy than those with low grit. And they have less negative emotion as well.
Let's get Dean in here from Norman, Oklahoma. Welcome, Dean, to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jean. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
As someone who's suffered from depression for over 50% of my life, I was wondering if there is a way that you could use grit in a treatment program towards mental disorders, kind of a way to instill a new tool for them to use to fight the battles they fight every day.
Yeah, well, first I want to tell you that I was surprised in interviewing paragons of grit, real exemplars of passion and perseverance, how many times they mentioned struggles just like you described. You know, they're not these invulnerable people who don't suffer from challenges like depression, like eating disorders. And what was remarkable to me is that these individuals were able to overcome real difficulty and not be afraid of saying, oh, by the way, I'm gritty, but I struggle with depression, and I'm you know, seeing somebody, and I'm, you know, taking my medication. Now, whether these insights about grit as I'm coming to them are relevant for clinical practice, for therapy, is a question that I hope to work on. But I think it will have to be with a real appreciation that, you know, some of the things that I don't know about, like clinical depression, you know, pathological levels of anxiety, you know, I wouldn't want to assume that the things that I'm studying that are in a, you know, context that are different, that would, you know, that I would have all the answers. That's all I want to say.
Tell me about the Character Lab that you co-founded. It's a nonprofit. Your mission is to advance the science and practice of character development in kids. What is it?
3 years ago, two educators with whom I had been working very intimately on questions of how to build grit and self-control in the classroom, their names are Dave Levin and Dominic Randolph. Dave Levin co-founded the KIPP Charter Schools, and Dominic Randolph is the headmaster of a private school called Riverdale in New York City. We got together a few years ago and said, you know, the work that we've been doing together is so important and so rare. You know, when do educators actually work closely with scientists on questions of character development? We created the Character Lab to make that rare occurrence common.
And in the classroom, practically speaking, what do you do?
We're trying to take insights about growth mindset and grit, self-control, emotional intelligence, gratitude. We're trying to take the science on it, you know, that will show you, for example, well, if you randomly assign kids to keep a journal of things that they're grateful for, you can reliably get kids to feel the emotion of gratitude, and that has downstream positive consequences for their behavior and their relationships. We're trying to take those basic insights and actually make them useful. And there's a yawning gap between a scientific study that shows that something is effective and a teacher knowing what to do Monday morning in the classroom.
You interviewed dozens of top achievers for this book, Angela Duckworth, leaders in business, athletics, academia, medicine, media, law. What was your takeaway? What was your takeaway?
The one thing I will say about these paragons of grit is they are human. You know, they often will, in the very first or second minute of the conversation, bring up a failure. You know, something that not, you know, it's not just sort of something that happened to them. Oftentimes they'll just tell you straight out how they screwed up. What's amazing to me about paragons of grit is that they're not perfect, but they're always trying to get better. That, to me, that spirit of what the Japanese call kaizen, always improving, is a theme in these paragons of grit that I have not found an exception to. Mm.
And now that you've studied this for so many years, what do you teach your own kids about grit?
Well, my kids are 13 and 14, so they are in the grips of adolescence. They are also at the exact age that many people begin to formulate and to deepen the interests that will guide the rest of their lives. I'm not saying that the fact that my 13-year-old plays viola or the fact that my 14-year-old is running means that they're going to grow up to be a musician and an athlete, but I do think that at that age, kids need to learn to work hard and need to find a way to deepen their interests rather than skip around all the time.
Angela Duckworth, author of Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. What a terrific book, and thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. It's been my true pleasure.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.